Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome to Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Susan Oxley from Seattle, Washington, and I'm a member of the North American Climate Justice Team, which is sponsored by the Greater Pacific Northwest Mission Center of Community of Christ. In this series, Climate Brewing, we are interviewing scientists, professors, and experts who've already given presentations as part of the climate webinar series, All of Creation, From Crises to Transformation. Today, I have with me Dr. Richard Waugh, Professor Emeritus from the University of Wisconsin. Rich brings to this webinar a specialty in social geography, his personal experiences with multiple populations struggling with the impact of climate change around the world, and his skill as a teacher. Rich is an elder in the Community of Christ and serves in the Lancaster, Wisconsin congregation, and he's also, yay, my brother. And it's a joy to talk with him about a topic that is near and dear to both our hearts, climate change. Rich, first of all, what does it mean to be a specialty, to have a specialty in social geography?
Well, and actually we tend to call it human geography, but it's it's the same basic thing. We're looking at the, my definition of geography is the stuff that makes the world make sense. You know, so it's information that makes the world make sense. And in this case, human geography is the stuff related to human and human cultures and human perceptions and human actions that help make the world make sense.
Okay.
And so it's very all-inclusive. It includes religion and economics, politics, language, culture, popular culture, all different kinds of things. But it also, a major part of what I have been doing is environmental perception is part of that too. So how people perceive the environment, because that's how they act in the environment. So the things I've spent the most time thinking about in this regard are religion and environmental perception. So I have some real interest in the environment as well.
Well, that's great. Well, you've done two webinars for us on climate change and human impact. And human impact can be interpreted in several ways. It could mean the impact that humans have had on the global environment and climate over time. It could mean the impact that climate change has had on humans, you know, with environmental emergencies and things like that. And it could mean the impact that humans can still have and exert on the growing climate crises. So you touched on all three of those in your webinars. And I'd like to start the discussion. I'd like to kind of touch on all three of those if we have time. And I'd like to start the discussion with the ways humans have impacted the environment and created climate change. We've had the IPCC report just recently, which I'll have you define. Then we also know that there's a portion of the population that still questions whether humans have had an impact on the climate or if it's just all natural progression. So I'd like to have you comment on both of those things, the IPCC report and that question of human impact on climate.
Yeah, so I'm sure a lot of your listeners know the IPCC stands for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's a consortium of many hundreds of scientists from around the world. And their job, in a simplistic way of putting it, is to read everything, study everything related to climate change. And there's just an unbelievable amount of stuff on climate change, thousands, tens of thousands of scholarly papers and so forth. So more than any one person could ever hope to read. So you get all these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of experts and specialists to read all this stuff and to study all this stuff. It's all stuff they know. They're all, you know, scientists who study climate change. And their job then is periodically they put out a summary of this. They just synthesize all of this information. And it's like, what do we know now about climate change? And they put out these reports at varying intervals. It's been a bit of a, it's usually 7 years is what they shoot for, is 7 years. And this one happened to be the sixth one. The first one came out in 1990. It's an interesting note that scientists were calling this climate change back in the 1980s when the IPCC was founded, because that's the name of the group. And the first report came out in 1990 and had a real impact. That first report did on the policies of some countries and so forth, and it helped lead to the Kyoto Accords and things like that. But the sixth report that came out is, I'll mention also, they tend to have a reputation for being sort of conservative. They don't call something unless they're really sure that's what's going on. They're not speculative at all. And if they do make any speculations, they tell you up front, you know, this is low confidence. We're not sure this is true, this part that I'm about to tell you, you know, it's not true. It may not be true. We don't know. We think it is, but we're not sure. But they have a lot of things that they say is high confidence. And this is like stuff you can bet the farm on is absolutely happening. And so what the sixth report, which just came out, I think, within the last month, one other thing the IPCC does, which is really useful, is they produce a short, the report's very long, but they make a short version of it, which is designed for policymakers. They want people who are involved in making policy to be able to understand all this stuff. So they write it in such a way that they hope that any reasonably cogent policymaker can understand. And those are short, 15 pages or 20 pages, something like that. And I'll be honest with you, that's the only part of it I've read myself so far. I haven't read the rest of it, but I have read the policy, the summary for policymakers. And in that, they're very open about the difficulties. Some of the highlights that came out of that is that they said each of the last four decades has been warmer than the previous decade. And every decade is setting a new record. They're unequivocal about this with very high confidence that this is anthropogenic. It's caused by people. It's also unequivocal, high confidence that, you know, carbon dioxide levels are increasing in the atmosphere, and they've got all the numbers you could possibly want to take a look at that. They spent a lot of time comparing historical things into current things and seeing how the trends are going. They make a point of saying that every single region on the earth is impacted. Every single region on the earth is suffering from climate change impacts now. Some even more so than others. Africa and Southeast Asia are among the ones that are suffering the most. So there's lots of good stuff in there. I would encourage people to, if they ever hear a politician saying, how am I supposed to know about climate change? I'm not a scientist. Then just tell them, well, IPCC is putting out things just for people like you. And there's no excuse for you not to know about climate change, because anybody can read the summary statement and should be able to understand it.
Okay.
So that's a little bit about the IPCC. Is that more than you wanted? So.
Thank you. That's good.
But you also mentioned something about whether human activity has really made any difference on climate change. Is it real? Is it all that kind of stuff? And that's an important issue, because a lot of people are looking for reasons, I think, not to want to do anything about it. So for those who wonder if climate change really is human caused, or if humans had anything to do with it, I'd like to point out that the human impact on the Earth has been enormous in the last century. Just really remarkable amounts of changes have taken place. We've done a few things in which we've done some positive remediation. Some kinds of air and water pollution in some places are better than it used to be. One thing which I think is hopeful is the Montreal Protocol has done allowed us to put a limit on ozone depleting gases, which seems to have checked the downward spiral of ozone depletion. And I think over the next few decades, we'll probably start seeing some recovery of that, some repair of that. So those are some positive things. But overall, the overall damage has been very real and very serious. And it's so extensive that a new geologic epoch called the Anthropocene is now being recognized. And I thought I'd mention something about this, because shifts in geologic periods of time are often marked by catastrophes. For example, the end of the Cretaceous period and the beginning of the Tertiary period coincides with the time when the asteroid hit the Earth and caused the mass extinctions, including those of the dinosaurs. And so what they're saying basically is the Tertiary world was so much different than the Cretaceous world that we need to have a new geologic, time period there. The establishment of the Anthropocene is simply an acknowledgement that humans have altered the Earth in such a profound way that a new geologic period of time is necessary to describe it. In other words, humans have produced such a change in the Earth's environment that it rivals the kinds of changes that caused new geologic periods in the past to be formed. So that's an indication of just the incredible impact that humans have had on the planet. It just looks different. The world is different than it would have been otherwise. Of all the systems of the Earth, though, the hardest hit has been the atmosphere. And that's where the processes which lead to climate change are basically occurring. And it's important to realize that the atmosphere is very, very thin. There's not much to it. Our whole life and our whole existence on this planet depends on just a few miles, basically, of atmosphere. 50% of it is only 3.5 miles thick off the surface of the Earth. And 80% of it is 11 miles. So that's not very much. But But in addition to that, the vast majority of the atmosphere, 99.9%, is comprised of three gases, nitrogen, oxygen, and argon. But the other 0.1% is a whole host of gases, which are called trace gases because they're found in very, very tiny amounts. And those trace gases are absolutely essential to us surviving on the planet. We absolutely have to have those, even though they're found in very, very small amounts. One of those trace gases is carbon dioxide. And because they occur in such really small amounts, it's very easy to have a profound impact on the relative amount of those gases. So
I didn't realize that carbon dioxide was a trace gas in the atmosphere. Yeah,
totally a trace gas.
My impression was that most of the atmosphere was carbon dioxide.
No, it's a trace gas. It's found in very, very small quantities.
You're talking about usually.
Even now. But the point being that since it's so little, analogy you might use is, this is probably a imperfect analogy, but if, pick a billionaire, Bill Gates is walking down the street and he sees a $20 bill on the concrete, he probably wouldn't even pick it up. Who cares, right? But if, because the impact of that is not very great on him, right? But if you had somebody who was an indigent or homeless man who saw a $20 bill, they would definitely pick it up because it would have a huge impact on their total amount of wealth because they had so little wealth to begin with, right? Well, in this case, carbon dioxide, there's so little of it that just a little bit of carbon dioxide is going to have a huge impact on changing that amount.
I see.
So people say, how can we possibly have you know, the atmosphere is so giant and big, and how can we possibly have had any kind of impact on this? Well, the truth is the atmosphere is not that big. And what we're impacting is a gas that's not found in very large quantities in the atmosphere, but is absolutely essential to us surviving on this planet. And right now, the levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are about 50% higher than they were at the beginning of the industrial age. So we've had a profound impact on how much carbon dioxide there's been in the atmosphere. You know, and it's easy to do because there wasn't that much to begin with, right? But we know for a fact, absolutely for a fact, that carbon dioxide is, traps heat in the atmosphere. So the fact that we've increased it by 50% means we there's no other way anything could happen except that the Earth would get warmer, because that's what carbon dioxide does in the atmosphere, is makes the Earth warm, you know. Of course, there was an equilibrium amount which kept the Earth at a very equitable temperature. We are messing with that now, and the amount of carbon dioxide is going up, like I said, to levels we haven't seen in the IPCC says in about 2 million years at least, if not more. So it's not surprising that the atmosphere is getting warmer. So for those who say humans just can't have that kind of impact and so forth, yes, they can. We have done it. We have put that much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere because it's easy to change that much carbon dioxide. I hope that explains it.
Yeah, thank you. That was very helpful. So we have impacted the climate via the amount of carbon dioxide and other gases like methane and stuff like that we've been putting in the atmosphere. And now the climate is impacting us in ways that certainly are making the news. I don't think anybody would deny that climate change affects us, and the catastrophes are just enormous.
Right.
I'd like to have you just comment, if you would, on the recent climate crises that are occurring, and maybe relate that in some way to the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and methane and whatever.
Yeah. So the list of climate change impacts on humanity is really very long. And I don't think we need to go through every one of them, because it would take hours and hours and hours to do that. But certainly, you know, some of the recently discussed problems that people have talked about in the media a lot and so forth have been things like heat waves and droughts and associated wildfires that have accompanied them. These are absolutely the fingerprints of climate change that are all over these events. None of these things would have happened the way they did without, you know, increased temperatures and the impacts of climate change. Southern Europe right now, even as we speak this very moment, is experiencing their worst heat wave ever. Spain, just yesterday, I think it was, set their all-time record high temperature. And 2 days ago, the all-time, which is 117.5 degrees. A couple days ago in Sicily, the all-time record high temperature for all of the continent of Europe was set at 120 degrees. It's not coincidental that tied to all of that, there are wildfires raging in the south of France right now, burning down towards the Mediterranean, including a bunch of towns down gradient there, which could be an interesting problem. Those kinds of things are not reported a lot in the American media, because we kind of tend to focus on ourselves a lot. But we've had similar kinds of things, as I think people know, in terms of the unusually high temperatures, the unusual long-term drought of the American West, and then the extensive wildfires, which have seemingly come every year now. And right now, again, even as we speak, we're looking at the Dixie Fire in California, which is the second largest fire in California history, has already burned two complete towns to the ground and is threatening a town, you'll appreciate this, threatening a town called Susanville, which has a population of 15,000 people. And they're already starting to evacuate people from Susanville for that. All of that, you know, is real implications or evidence of climate change being very real. We should point out these are not just local events or local impacts. I live in Platteville, Wisconsin, and during the time of the Bootleg Fire in Oregon, which is 2,000 miles away from us, we had, for multiple days in a row, we had unhealthy air conditions here in Platteville from the smoke from the Bootleg Fire and some other fires in the Pacific Northwest. And we had people who were having, I noticed it. I could smell the fire, and people with respiratory problems were having real serious issues. That's 2,000 miles away. So what's happening is these things are starting to happen every year. Europe seems to have heat waves every summer now. They've even had heat waves in the late winter, much warmer temperatures than they should have. We're seeing these wildfires every year in the West. And this is becoming the new normal. And this is going to continue to be a problem, I think, for most of the 21st century. We should also point out that Death Valley last month recorded 130 degrees, which is the highest, it's usually assumed to be the highest precisely measured temperature that any human has ever recorded on planet Earth. That's an incredibly high temperature. So we're seeing this thing happening over and over and over again. There's all kinds of other things we can talk about in terms of human impacts. Larger and more numerous hurricanes, and we're seeing hurricanes hitting earlier in the season, lasting later in the season, hitting more frequently, land masses and so forth. We've seen the spread of disease amongst human beings. A wide variety of those are tied to climate change because, of course, ecosystems are moving poleward with the increasing temperatures. We've seen
pursue that a minute, Rich.
Sure.
Excuse me, but explain a little bit more why increased disease is related to climate change. Make that connection for me a little more clear.
Well, I can give you a specific example. There's a tick that is called the Lone Star tick. And it's got that name for apparently two reasons. One, it was very common in Texas, which is the Lone Star State. But they're also the female of the tick has a big white dot on her back. And it looks like a lone star, you know. Unfortunately, this is one of the ticks that carries a disease. It's called Lone Star Ehrlichiosis. And it can be very serious. It can be debilitating, and if it's not treated properly, it can be debilitating for decades. It can even be fatal in some cases. But this was a disease that was only found in the southern states, in Texas and places like that. Over the last few years, we've now had multiple cases of that in Wisconsin.
Oh.
So what's happened is the warm belt that allows for the Lone Star tick to survive is moving northward, and the ticks are moving with it. And they've come into Wisconsin, and now we're starting to get that disease here, you see. And this has happened over and over again. The West Nile virus, which is spread throughout the entire United States, first came to the United States in 1999. And it was a climate change thing. The Zika virus was spread through climate change as it moved to other areas. And there's, we can go on and on. Malaria is making a resurgence, especially in Africa, from zones which are getting, especially elevation zones, which are, you know, becoming warmer through climate change. And there's lots and lots of other examples of that, but those are some of the examples.
Do you think that our recent pandemic has anything to do with climate change, or is that speculative?
That would be very speculative, and I don't have any information on that, so I'm not going to speculate on that too much.
Okay.
I think that the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, has a lot more to do with the globalized economy, and the fact that it spread so rapidly was because we're so incredibly interconnected. And also because people refuse to do the right thing to help contain the spread of it. We could have controlled it much more easily if people had done the right thing. It may turn out that it had something to do with climate change. I don't know that yet, though, and I'm not going to speculate on that.
Okay, thank you for an honest answer. I just was curious.
Yeah, sure. So okay. Those are all some of the things that, you know, where it's impacted people.
Well, I've also heard recently that the Gulf Stream is becoming less stable.
Yes, it is.
And that could impact a huge number of nations. Do you want to talk to us about that?
Yeah, the Gulf Stream is complicated, to say the least. Most people, I think, have heard of the Gulf Stream as you can think of it as like a river of water in the ocean. it's a current in the ocean. It forms in the tropical oceans near the equator, just north of the equator, off the coast of Africa. So it's a hot current. It's a warm current, and swings across the Atlantic Ocean and then makes a big turn around a giant kind of permanent high-pressure system that resides over Bermuda in that area. Just makes a big turn and then shoots back across the northern Atlantic Ocean, and it bathes Europe in this relatively warm water, which is why Europe, which is at a really high latitude, like central Canada latitudes, is way less cold usually than central Canada is. And this is one reason why Europe was populated and has 700 million people living there, is because they had this really spectacular, wonderful weather because of the Gulf Stream. So now the Gulf Stream, now Europe is not, their weather is not quite so spectacular because it's getting increasingly warm. That's mostly from atmospheric warming, but the Gulf Stream itself does look to be becoming unstable. And the reason why is because of melting from the Arctic ice, Arctic sea ice in the Arctic Ocean. And when that ice melts, it's melting at rates never seen before. Again, the IPCC points this out, that it's melting at rates never seen before. And there's a chance that the Arctic Ocean will be ice-free as soon as 2030, something like that, without any ice at all in the summertime. It'll reform in the winter, but then it'll be gone in the summer. So all that ice goes someplace, and it's going down two currents. One's called the Labrador Current, one's called the Greenland Current. And those are cold currents, and they're pointed perpendicularly right at the Gulf Stream. Uh-oh. So what it's doing is just like a head-on, a broadside collision with the Gulf Stream. And this is causing the Gulf Stream to become unstable. So there's all kinds of speculation on what's going to happen with the Gulf Stream. It's already showing signs of instability, though. And what impact that's going to have on Europe is hard to say. Lots of speculations, but that's one of the things people have talked about.
Okay, and there's also rivers of air in the atmosphere that are fairly permanent, or have been fairly permanent, that are also showing signs of instability. Is that correct?
That's true. The upper airflow is what it's often called. It forms where you have cold air in the north and warm air in the south, and where they hit, there's a really strong temperature gradient, and it's not necessary to go through the physics of it right now, but if any of you know the ideal gas law, you can use that gas law to prove that temperature gradients create pressure gradients, you know. And so since the pressure gradient is being created by the temperature contrast, what's happening is you get a river of air in the atmosphere, which is flowing along. And it's hugely important in determining what weather we get down here at the surface. It often goes through cycles where it will swing wildly up and down, north and south, and then it'll go kind of straight across east-west without moving and so forth. And what we're seeing now is that looping action is much greater than it used to be. So one of the reasons why you know, the Pacific Northwest got such an incredible spell of hot weather, that was in June, I believe, was because the upper airflow was wildly, it's called azonal, wildly up and down, and it brought really warm air up, which then got trapped on a high pressure that was just offshore, and the Pacific Northwest just sweltered. I think you had temperatures of 115 or 16 or 17 degrees, didn't you?
That's right.
That's unheard of. You know, that's the kind of stuff that happens. But it also explains why Texas got such a bizarre cold snap in this last winter, because the upper airflow was deeply diving south and brought all that Arctic air, sucked it all down. And so you're getting these bigger extremes of the upper airflow. And so Texas is mostly just going to be blazing hot, but they could not and probably have really cold winters every once in a while, like they did this last year. And, you know, places that normally don't get 115 degrees might start getting that more frequently.
I see.
So that is becoming a little more unstable, because you're getting bigger temperature contrasts between the air masses, which are causing the upper airflow. And so it means that it's more mobile, it's more unstable.
So, Rich, the developing nations that you've been talking about, like Europe, like the United States, we've also got Australia and New Zealand and, you know, a number of other industrialized nations. And we, because of our industrialization, we are responsible for getting a great deal of the carbon dioxide into the atmosphere with all of our fossil fuel and petroleum-based products. And yet, you've mentioned that the places that are experiencing some of the worst of the climate crises include Southeast Asia and Africa that are not industrialized. So when we start talking about human impact, it's not equal across the board. There
right.
is no equity. And the climate doesn't care whether there's equity or not. It's what it does.
That is indeed true. It's a truly unfortunate truth that the way our society is structured, that people who are marginalized or have little always suffer the worst in any kind of crisis or disaster or catastrophe. And for reasons which are not important to go into now, but there are certainly areas of the world which have been made to be poor by the processes that have made us wealthy, you know. And so there's an enormous gaps between rich and poor nations and rich and poor people. And the more money you have, the more fossil fuels you're going to, you know, in general, the more fossil fuels you'll put out into the atmosphere. But the atmosphere is incredibly well mixed. It's extremely well mixed. Just as an example of that, I read somewhere that every time you take a breath, the odds are that you're breathing molecules that have been through the respiratory system of everybody else on Earth. You know, that's how thoroughly mixed the atmosphere is. And so it means that even though we have a lot of carbon dioxide coming out of the United States and Europe and Japan, places like that, it's mixed throughout the Earth. And so the impacts are found throughout the Earth. It's just that the impacts are more substantial in places where they don't have the money for remediation of those. You can imagine the South American South is going to have a real problem with climate change, because it's going to get almost unlivably hot in the next few decades. But they have air conditioning, you know, and they can always just retreat into their, as long as the power holds out, they can retreat into their homes and their cars and so forth. A place like, you know, the areas of the Sahel, for example, in Africa, which are also blisteringly hot, they don't have that. They're living in 110, 115, 120 degrees, you know, and that takes it out of you, and it's limited. It's kind of a limit of what you can do, you know, in terms of developing yourself and so forth. And so it's going to hit them much harder, you know, than it would somebody in Mobile, Alabama, for example. And that's just the way it goes. So I would argue that we have a responsibility to other people, you know, knowing this. There's some people say, oh, I don't think it's bothering me very much. So, you know, it doesn't, no big deal for me. So why should I care? That seems to me ethically inappropriate to argue that something is only important if it affects me directly. That seems like a shallow ethic for people to have. But there's a couple of things you can say about that. One is that climate change is affecting every single square inch of the planet right now. And it's affecting every single person on the planet. And maybe you don't recognize that because you've got all the infrastructure, you know, filters, which are keeping you going in the midst of all this. But it's very true, and it's going to get worse. But it's also, I would think people would start feeling a responsibility to the people when they realize that what I'm doing is causing other people to suffer really seriously. So right now we're looking at, I just read one report, they're thinking maybe 500,000 deaths a year right now from climate change in the world. My. Something on that order. It's hard to know, but something on that order. And then another report I read recently said that the lifetime emissions of 3.5 Americans leads to one death from climate change. Now, that doesn't sound...
3.5?
Americans? Will lead to a death. And I'm not sure exactly how that was calculated, but these were people who knew what they were doing. That doesn't sound like much, but you realize we have we have 335 million people in the United States. That's close, meaning that America, the United States, is going to be responsible for 100 million deaths from climate change. That's our responsibility. And most of that's going to come from some other places. And you can use that kind of metric to see the relative impact of climate change. Other industrialized advanced nations don't have a number nearly like that. The UK, for example, their number is 9.4 people. So it's one third as much of an impact per person as in the United States. And of course, in other countries, in Brazil, it's 26 people. Or in Nigeria, it's 146. You know, so there's a real difference in how the relative impact that people have on this, and the responsibility that we have, I think, for caring for other people is a reason in and of itself for us to do something about this. I mean, what kind of people would we be if we said, I don't care if 100 million people die? You know, I got my goodies. I mean, who really thinks that way, you know? But that's kind of where we're at now with this. So it's really kind of shocking. And I should say that one of the authors of that study said they're convinced also that their numbers are a vast underestimate. They think it's way worse than that. So they were, again, being conservative on those numbers, but they think it's way worse than that, meaning the United States would be responsible for even more deaths than that 3.5 figure would suggest. Now, I'm not trying to beat up on the United States. I'm just saying that it seems like there's a place there for us to ethically and morally take responsibility for doing something to try to help people live better lives.
What is that something? What should we be doing?
Well, I would argue there's probably three big categories of, I mean, at first I should say, you know, the human race isn't doomed. Everybody isn't going to die. But unfortunately, a lot of people are going to die. Another study said 83 million are going to die by 2100, and that's definitely an underestimate. You know, it's going to be more than that, almost everybody seems to think. So what should we do if we do care about this? And I think there are three general categories. I think technology is going to have a role to play. There's lots of people who are working very hard on trying to find technological fixes, energy sources which don't depend or don't produce carbon, for example, ways of using carbon, using energy more effectively and more efficiently so you don't use so much of it. And I think all of those are going to be important. I have a couple of, a couple of concerns about technology. One is a lot of people think it's going to solve the problem completely. And I'm sure it will not solve the problem completely. And in fact, for technology to help at all, it requires that we do the other two categories, is the only way we can make technology work. So it's not going to solve the problem by itself, but it's going to have a role to play. The other thing I worry about with technology is there's some really far out technological solutions that people have suggested, which are going to be unbelievably expensive, probably completely impractical, and have a real good chance of causing more damage than they're going to help. So we have to be careful with that. We need to start talking about appropriate technology. What's appropriate for this? Here's something where we can do that. We have not been good at all about looking at the social cost of technology. If somebody invents something, people use it regardless of what it does to people, and we need to start thinking about social costs of technology, I think. But technology will have a role to play. But I think there's another category of things that people can do, and which are going to be, it's going to be critical, is to make structural changes in society. It's a simple logic. The way we've built the world, the way we built our culture especially, is what's caused the problem. This is what's caused climate change. We can't continue doing that.
Right.
Expect it to fix the problem, So we're going to have to rethink the way we've structured our society, which is going to mean real strong structural alterations. I really think one of the things we can do is for people to start really taking democracy seriously. And by that, I mean to do the really hard work of seriously investing in finding out what people who are running for office really believe. And finding the people who are committing themselves to doing something about climate change in a positive way, and voting for those people. Mm-hmm. Our democracy has devolved to the place where it's sort of a, if I vote for this guy, it'll make you mad, so I'm going to vote for you for this guy. Or this guy's got a flashy commercial on television or on the internet that I liked, and we need a more serious connection to democracy where people really look seriously at this and then make it a priority to vote for people who are going to do something. And the reason why this is important is because a lot of the ways of addressing this have to come from upper levels. Law is really critical in all this. The Paris Accords of 2015 are a good example of that. If we can abide by those accords, it's a small step, but it's a step forward in addressing climate change. Without that, we wouldn't have that small step forward. There really is a role to play for law and for international cooperation and so forth. We need politicians who are going to commit to that, and we need Americans who are going to find those people and vote for them.
So when we are hearing about the Glasgow summit that is coming up in November, that would be in this category of international guidelines and law.
Right, exactly. There have been annual summits, climate change summits, starting in 1992, I think. Most of them don't make much press. The Paris one that gave us those accords in 2015 was one of those. And they're designed, and the Glasgow one is going to be important because they're reviewing the Paris Accords and reviewing how people have adopted those. And they're going to try to hold people's feet to the fire to try to get them to do more of that.
I see. Yeah.
But these are important. And I put a lot of stock in this. I think this is going to be a real part of the solution. We also need to do that in domestic, around the world. We need to have democracy around the world and domestic policies from politicians and from policymakers and so forth who are going to address climate change in a positive way. A really dangerous thing that's for some reason is widely believed is that all politicians are exactly alike and they're all idiots. This is not true. There are good people out there who are trying to do the right thing, and they're not all alike. And you need to sort through all of this and find the good from the bad and in real ways. Another structural change, which I think is important, is in terms of the way we think about economic systems. Our economic systems is what brought us this problem. We cannot continue doing our economic systems the way we always have. We need to develop and embrace economic systems that put a priority on environment, that going to make that important as profits, or even more important than profits, and climate change in particular. So that needs to become a really extremely important part of the decision making in economics. And it has never been that way in our culture, and that's why we have this problem. We need to make sure that becomes part of that, and people have to buy into that and do that. So that's the second thing that people can do is to seek out those kinds of solutions.
Okay.
The third one. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I just wanted to make sure that I was following. Okay.
Yeah. The third category is lifestyle changes. These are at the individual level. And there's a lot to be said for individuals to examine their own lives and see where they can make a difference. One of the things which I think is absolutely essential is our culture and our society is strongly based on individualism. And there's a lot of good evidence to suggest that individualism has been increasing in recent decades to the point where it's become toxic. And we need to let that go. We have got to get out beyond ourselves. I think we're not only at a point, we're beyond the point where we have to start thinking about community, thinking about other people. It may seem like a kumbaya, poster kind of thing, and that's trite and all that, but it is absolutely, I think, fundamental to the solution of climate change. We have to start thinking about other people. We have to develop political systems and economic systems and individual lifestyles based on the idea that other people matter. That other people are important, not just me. It's not just what I want. It's other people are important. If we do that, then climate change can be very effectively addressed. It means that people will think about their purchases in terms of how that impacts other people. They'll be thinking about how their politics affects other people. They'll be thinking about how their recreation affects other people, how their religion affects other people, how pretty much everything they do affects other people. And in all of that, the way we live and think and worship and consume and learn, all of that has to be pursued with the idea that we have a responsibility to provide for the good of the larger community. I'm absolutely convinced this is where we're going to have to go. We have to somehow develop this. We have to get beyond this. Humans have the capacity to live that way. People do it. There are people out there who are living this way, To live in selfish individualism is a choice we make. We're not destined to do that. It's a choice we make. We decide we're going to do that. And I would argue that it's not inevitable. We can choose to live in a way, or we can try to build sustainable communities around the world, you know, if for no other reason than those places we mentioned in Africa or Southeast Asia or whatever, which are suffering so much, will suffer less. And maybe we won't have 100 million people die. You know, maybe we won't. Maybe we'll care for them. But I think it's more than that. I think that by thinking about this and looking at the broader picture and seeing how the world is going to be impacted, our own lives will become more sustainable. And we'll be thinking about how other people can do that. And so it'll be easy for us to know what to do, you know, what to buy, how to act, where to go, and you know, how we worship and all, how we do religion, how we do education, how we do all these things, you know. It all seems like it's going to work. So it seems like living that way means we'll embrace appropriate technology and community-oriented politics and economics and religion and adopt lifestyles that are environmentally sustainable. And if we do, the specter of climate change is going to diminish. It absolutely will. It's hard because we have the world we have because people like it. They like all the stuff. They like all the things. They like the really fast trucks that they drive. They like all this stuff, you know. They like having 14, you know, snowmobiles and boats and cars and trucks and things. They like that kind of stuff. It's fun. It's exciting. But I guess what I'm arguing is we need to get beyond ourselves at some point and say, I don't need all that stuff. And if I don't have all that stuff, maybe there's more for other people and maybe there'll be less carbon dioxide being generated, you know. And that's just one example. But I mean, there's lots of ways I think this can impact how people live their lives. It seems utopian and maybe even naive. I'm sure people are thinking that. But I'm convinced that people have that capacity if they just do it. If they just start thinking about other people and make that a commitment in their lives. I think we have that capacity. And I'm hoping for it.
I'm hoping with you, Rich. Thank you very much. It's about time to close out our podcast now, but are there any additional comments, any closing comments you'd like to make that would be helpful?
Well, I hope they'll be helpful, but we'll see.
Okay.
There's a lot of people who fit into the category of climate deniers. And the one that people often think about are the people who don't believe in the science, who don't believe that it's being just manufactured out of nothing, or they, for political reasons, they don't want to believe in it. But there's another kind of, it seems to me, there's another kind of climate denier, the people who have just kind of given up and have just felt like there's nothing I can do. It's too big of a problem. What difference does it make if I do anything?
Right.
You know, my neighbors aren't doing anything. Why should I? You know, that kind of thing. And it seems like this is a time when we can bring in maybe an ethical approach or an ethical view of climate change, because it seems to me that climate change lends itself to this kind of idea of thinking about it ethically. You know, in this podcast, we've talked a little bit about some of the real problems and some of the impact on people and the fact that people are dying, you know, and this kind of raises the ethical stakes, I think. And when you start getting lots of people suffering and dying, it seems to me that there's a right and a wrong here. And the right is to try to keep people alive and help them live better lives. That seems to me to be the right. And so I would argue for those who sometimes just feel like they've just given up because there's no hope or something like that. This is a time to think of it from an ethical point of view. And just say there's something about just doing the right thing, which is very useful, very good. it may be that your neighbors aren't doing anything about it or don't care, but at least you can do something about it, you know, and by doing the right thing, you're contributing to a solution, to helping to deal with the problem. And you may not see it. You may not see grand vistas opening up in front of you or something like that. But the idea that you know that by your actions, you are not as responsible as some others perhaps for causing human suffering or destruction of the earth or something like that. There's a joy in that, just simply knowing that you do the right thing. And so I would encourage people to maybe think of it ethically and hope that would be something they can just do it because it's right.
So whether I ever see the results or not, whether I live to see things change for the better, it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
because I'm doing the right thing. I made the right choice.
I kind of agree with that. It'd be great if you could see the results of your actions, and we'd like to see that. But just doing what's right is a reward in its own self, just doing the right thing. Again, it sounds almost trite to say that, but there's a lot of truth and wisdom, I think, in that. So
wonderful. Thank you, Rich.
You betcha.
That's a good closing comment. I appreciate your being available and giving us your time and energy to do the podcast for us and to do the webinars. For those of you who would like to see the webinars that Rich did for us, they're on seaofchristclimatejustice.org. So check us out. They're all archived there, and you can watch those webinars and others as well.
Great. Thanks. It's my pleasure to do this. I really enjoyed that, and I appreciate the honor you gave me in bringing me in and letting me be part of this.
Thank you. I appreciate your being part of this. Yay. Go, Rich. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye for now.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.